I'm going to open talking a little bit about my own background and why I'm particularly focused on depleted uranium as an issue. I got some news a couple of days ago, which was really distressing. One of my best friends is a captain in the California National Guard, and he was activated last fall for a two-year tour, and he's currently in Iskandaria in just south of Baghdad. And they were hit by a mortar attack, and two of the people in his company were killed, and several others were injured. And it hits home very personally for me because last time we went to war with Iraq, I was over there. I was a 19-year-old soldier. I enlisted in April of 1990, which gives me the all-time award for good timing because I graduated basic training 4 days after Iraq invaded Kuwait. And that day when we graduated basic training, our orders for Europe were canceled. And we were quickly ferried down to Fort Stewart, Georgia on board a Kentucky Air National Guard cargo aircraft and were promptly deployed to Saudi Arabia. Which I can tell you, as a 19-year-old kid, I was scared out of my mind. But that was my view at the time was that that was what it was about. I was a soldier. I believed in my country. I believed in what we were doing. I looked at what we were doing as liberating Kuwait, notwithstanding the fact that we were defending a pretty dictatorial monarchy. The fact was, is at the time, I really, really did believe in what I was doing. In any event, we waited out there in the desert for all those months, and that was really the time I spent learning about my job, which was as an Abrams tank crewman. If you've been watching the news, you'll see them frequently driving around Iraq. The Abrams tank is a 63-ton vehicle, and it carries depleted uranium rounds. Now, if you read the newspapers, you'll see terms like uranium-tipped or uranium-coated, or various things like this. And I want to disabuse you of those notions. These munitions are not tipped or coated with uranium. They are solid uranium. And the round that the Abrams tank fires is 10.7 pounds of solid uranium. It's a penetrator about this long, about an inch in diameter. And then it's encased with all the explosive propellant and all of that. There was a little bit of discussion at the very end of the last session about whether it was fissionable or not. The bottom line with these weapons is it's a kinetic energy weapon. What that means is that the simple force of the velocity, how fast it moves, is so fast that it causes tremendous destruction. I saw an incident where we fired at an Iraqi tank from a good mile distance, and the turret, which probably weighed 18 or 20 tons, flew up in the air, end over end, and landed 100 feet away from the hull of the tank. That's how destructive these weapons are. And that was, again, and that was the kinetic energy. That wasn't an explosive energy. It was simply just like hitting somebody with a fist, but dozens of times the speed of sound. I don't know exactly how fast they go. I used to know that because it was one of the things we had to memorize in the Army. My unit crossed the border into Iraq on February 24th of 1991. By that time, I'd turned 20, just a few days before the ground war started, and we moved for approximately 48 hours without stopping, without sleeping, without engaging the enemy. We just moved north. We were way out there in the desert on the far left flank of all the American forces that were invading Iraq. And we finally came up at this place they called Battle Position 102 on our maps. And it was an Iraqi infantry brigade that was dug in with the intent of defending the main highway leading from Basra to Baghdad. They were facing in the wrong direction because they believed, quite rightly, that U.S. forces would be coming up from the direction of Kuwait. however, we had, you know, the GPSs and all of this stuff, and we did something that had never really been done in military history before, which drove through trackless desert for those 2 days. And we came and attacked these people from behind and by surprise, and I don't know how many exactly we killed. My understanding is that a few hundred prisoners were taken after the fact, but, you know, if you saw the images on television of all of the Iraqis coming up out of their trenches and raising their hands and surrendering, we didn't see any of that because we were going too fast. And we were shooting everything, everybody we saw. One of my best friends describes it as the biggest and fastest firing squad in history. They didn't have a chance. We came out of a sandstorm. We were shooting at them from these massive vehicles, and these tanks each have three machine guns plus the cannon that fires 120 millimeter round, and so the destructive power of just one is incredible. But you know, we had 64 of them, and again, the Iraqis just never had a chance. We rolled over them. This went on for several hours as we went through their position, and again, I have no idea how many were killed. We didn't fire many of the depleted uranium rounds in that particular action because the DU rounds are primarily used against armored targets, and what we were dealing with in this case was bunkers and trucks and things like that, and so the Army uses high explosive rounds for those situations. What happens when you fire a DU round at a truck, for example, is it penetrates the skin, it goes right through, it comes out the other side, it keeps flying. What really changed my whole direction in life, and the reason I'm standing here today, is that around 2 o'clock that morning, we had finally reached the Highway 8, which is the highway that leads from Baghdad down towards Basra. And our orders were fairly simple. We were to prevent reinforcements from coming down to the Iraqi army, which was at that point being decimated by the U.S. 7th Corps. And so our orders were not to let anybody through. And we took turns sleeping for an hour at a time. And I finally got to sleep for an hour after, you know, days being awake. And if you've ever stayed awake for 2 or 3 days at a time, you'll know that your judgment starts to be pretty severely impaired. People start hallucinating. I mean, it's an incredibly bizarre situation. But at the same time, we were so afraid that the adrenaline was bearing us up. In any event, I was awakened by a call over the radio that there were trucks to our front, and I jumped up and looked out of the turret, and I could see these two trucks. And they were silhouetted because we were on the edge of a large Iraqi logistics base, which had been bombed for some weeks, and it was on fire. All it was on fire. It's like the whole horizon was burning red, and these two trucks were sitting there. And my wingman tank opened fire, and it hit one of the trucks, and it was a fuel truck, and it splashed burning diesel fuel all over the other one. That one turned out had troops in it, or people in it. I don't know for sure that they were in the military, because we didn't take the time to find out. They came running out, and they were on fire, and the human reaction, the humane thing to do when you see someone on fire is to get a fire extinguisher, it's to get a blanket, it's to help them, it's to get them medical care. But the military doesn't teach you to do the humane thing. They don't teach you to do the human thing. What they teach you to do, and you drill it over and over and over again, is to deal with the threat. And at that point, in our minds, which were so twisted by what had been happening, those men who were unarmed and running away and on fire were a threat. And I and my platoon sergeant and the other people with our unit gunned them down with machine guns, and we killed every last one of them. And it was over in about 30 seconds. But then it never ended. For the families of those people we killed, who again I assume were military but may not have been, they might have just been trying to get out of the area. For their families, they probably never even knew what happened to their loved ones. For the people in my unit, their lives were basically destroyed. In the months afterwards, we saw alcoholism, we saw suicides, we saw one attempted homicide, we saw divorces because people came home and they were so filled with rage and anger inside that they abused their spouses and got into trouble, got thrown in jail. So it was a disaster. But then we finally came to the ceasefire after, you know, several days of this. And, you know, meanwhile, I couldn't believe it when I got home. It was like coming home from Mars, because there were all these images of this high-tech war, and it was so clean and pretty, and the Vietnam syndrome was over. You know, look at the pretty cruise missile going down the chimney and destroying the building, and nobody gets hurt. And that was the image that the Pentagon wants everyone to have of the first Gulf War. It's impossible for them to do that for the second Gulf War, but they've still managed to maintain that myth that the first Gulf War was all clean and pretty, but I'm telling you, it wasn't. So we get the orders for the ceasefire at like 2 o'clock in the morning on February 28th, and the irony was there was an artillery unit about 100 yards behind us, and the order that came down to us was, you know, don't fire unless fired upon, etc. But the ceasefire didn't go into effect until shortly after sunrise. And so the artillery unit behind us made the decision that they were going to try to expend every last round of ammunition they had and kill as many Iraqis as they possibly could before the ceasefire went into effect. And so as the announcement of the ceasefire was coming over our radios, that artillery unit behind us started firing. For those of you who aren't familiar with the military, the distinction between artillery is that it's indirect fire. It goes up in the air in a ballistic trajectory and comes down. So they fire it from miles away sometimes. And they were shelling an Iraqi unit that was leaving Kuwait. And that went on for hours. And at that point, I was the only person awake in my tank. And I took out my .45 pistol and I stuck it in my mouth. And I almost blew my brains out. Because every time I closed my eyes, I could see this man running across my field of vision from left to right as I got him down with a machine gun. And I think the only reason I didn't do it was because the people in my tank crew depended on me, and because I felt like I had to do something to make life meaningful after that. So if you've read Cy Hirsch's article in The New Yorker from back in 2000, the ceasefire wasn't actually the end of the conflict phase of the war, because a couple of days later, on March 2nd, a very large Iraqi unit was leaving Kuwait, moving up into Iraq, and they were passing through the Ramallah oil fields. The terrain there, and actually the movie, if you watched it, showed some scenes from there. It's very boggy, and so vehicles like tanks and heavy trucks, if they go off the road, they sink down to their to the hubs of the wheels, and they can't move. And so this large Iraqi unit with thousands of soldiers and hundreds of tanks was stuck on a causeway. And at some point, one of their units and one of our units engaged with each other. They opened fire. You know, one scout shot at another. Nobody really knows what happened, and I've heard conflicting accounts. But the point was, is a couple shots were exchanged, and our response, the response from the U.S. military, was to respond with overwhelming force. And so they moved the entire 24th Infantry Division, which I was a member of, with our 26,000 soldiers, hundreds and hundreds of tanks and helicopters and everything else. We moved forward and attacked that Iraqi unit while their tanks were still on the back of trucks, mind you. They were leaving Kuwait, and we attacked them. And my unit was given the mission of going up this particular causeway where the helicopters had destroyed the vehicles at the front and destroyed the vehicles at the back, and so the entire column was trapped on this causeway. It's two-lane blacktop through the oil fields. And we went up there weaving through this mess of vehicles and tanks, shooting as the Iraqis fled. And then the rules of engagement for us were if they're armed or running, shoot them. That's what they said. You know, if they're walking calmly as they're being attacked, then let them up. So we went up this causeway, destroying everything in our path, killing everyone in our path. And about halfway up that road, one of the tanks in my unit, it was two vehicles ahead of us in our column, suffered a massive explosion. I don't know if it was friendly fire or if something fell into the turret or whatever, but all of the ammunition in the back exploded. And the way the Abrams tank is designed is it's got this several inches of steel in between the crew compartment and the ammunition compartment. And there's a very light panel bolted on the top so that if there's an explosion, all the force goes straight up. And that's what happened in this instance. We saw the explosion and we knew it was one of our tanks. And my platoon sergeant and I saw the crew getting out because the crew survived. And we got down and we ran up to the tank and we got the injured men and started to pull them away. And we were enveloped in this cloud of black smoke because all of the rounds were burning in the back of the tank. And I got this thought in the back of my head after the battle was over, which was, you know, gosh, 20 or so of those rounds were made out of depleted uranium. And they were on fire, and I was breathing the smoke. And what does that mean for the future? I didn't have time to think about it then, but you know, after the war was over and I knew people who were getting sick, I knew a lot of people who were getting sick, I really started to worry. And you know, I asked around about it, and I was still in the military, and the answers I got were, well, it's depleted. It can't hurt you. I ended up filing for conscientious objector status about 6 months after the war, and I won't go into any details of that because I don't have enough time. Although my platoon sergeant said, Miles, you're a dollar short and a day late, which he was right about, but I couldn't see serving in the military any longer. And after I got out, I figured that what I needed to do was find some way to make my life matter because of what I'd done. I really hated myself. And as I told you, you know, everyone in our unit was absolutely just destroyed by what had happened. So I got involved in working on Gulf War veterans' illnesses, and one of the issues we were really concerned about was depleted uranium. Now, we heard a little bit about this study that has been done on Gulf War veterans, but I want to make sure that that you're aware that the study is a total sham. The Pentagon was aware of several hundred veterans who had what they called Class 1 or Class 2 exposures, which meant they were either in a vehicle when it was hit and therefore likely got a very large inhalation dose of depleted uranium, or they climbed in a vehicle afterwards and they were part of a recovery crew, or they took it back. They spent a significant amount of time in the vehicle. There were many thousands more who climbed on top of Iraqi tanks to get their pictures taken and stuff like that. And I know some of those folks later tested positive with depleted uranium in their urine, just from this incidental contact. But the Pentagon chose to provide less than 100 names to the Department of Veterans Affairs of people who should be studied. And they ended up only studying about 30 people. The VA said, you know, sorry, this study is too small to determine cancer incidence. You can't take 30 people and extrapolate that to a population of many thousands and come up with anything. But despite that fact, and despite the fact that the Pentagon, and if you watch their briefings, they'll say, well, we haven't, up until 2001 or so, they were saying, we haven't seen any cancers in this population of Gulf War veterans. And then around 2001 or 2002, they started saying, we haven't seen any bone cancers or lung cancers. And the reason they changed that was because they'd been called on the fact that they were lying. Because their own documents and their own journal articles that are published show that at least one of those vets had lymphoma. And we were contacted, the National Gulf War Resource Center, I was on the board at the time, was contacted by a vet who was in the study who had a bone tumor. So if the VA and if the Pentagon are walking around publicly saying, we're studying these vets, they're perfectly healthy, they don't have cancer, they don't have any other ill health effects, and yet we know from their documents and from personal contact that at least two out of the 30 some odd they've studied did have some form of cancer. And what does that tell us about the study? That it's politically motivated, that it's being manipulated, that the science is being twisted around in order to serve the Pentagon's needs. The Pentagon loves this weapon. They absolutely love it. It's not because it's not just because it's, you know, the so-called silver bullet and all that, and that they really overstate how effective it is. The vast majority of the tanks that were destroyed in the first Gulf War were destroyed by conventional weapons. However, for tank-to-tank combat, it is incredibly effective, and they don't want to give it up for anything. And the fact is they're twisting the science to prove their point. I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of the Pentagon research. The Pentagon's got this interesting group that they're funding called the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute, which has been spending the last several years busy in planting rats with pellets of depleted uranium and exposing human bone cultures to depleted uranium. And what they have found repeatedly is that if you take rats or human bone cells and expose it to this stuff, then you'll get a whole range of health problems. So the laboratory studies that are published, again, published in the journals, directly contradict what the Pentagon is telling us. Why they don't reference their own research, I can't answer. And then there's the Iraqi studies. We heard a little bit about that just now. The incident rates of malignancies, of childhood cancers, is through the roof. What the Pentagon will say, and they say it all the time, is, well, those studies were done under Saddam Hussein, and he was evil. They're politically motivated. They're manipulating the science. This is what the Pentagon's talking about, somebody else's science. Well, the Iraqi scientists who did this research still stand by their data, even though Saddam Hussein's long gone. Okay, at least some of them do. The main author of the studies was actually killed in a car accident this past January. So one of the things that common sense tells you about science and the scientific method is you want to try to duplicate the results. You want to have another group of scientists go and look at the same data or the same situation and see if they can replicate it. And the World Health Organization got the bright idea that they would go into Iraq and they would study it. Well, the United States lobbied successfully to prevent that from happening. In November of 2001, we managed to get a vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations to prevent the World Health Organization from going in and studying the situation. It's a really controversial issue for a lot of reasons. I mean, a lot of Americans will say, well, we support whatever's best for the troops and making sure they're safe and all of that stuff. But the fact is that it's clearly not best for the troops to be exposed to stuff that's going to cause cancer and all these health effects, and then turn around and not provide them with adequate medical care, without adequate treatment or any of those things. It's clearly not best for the troops. The troops are worried about it. There was an incident not too long ago where a Danish unit came into an area where American troops had been camped for some months. And the Danish troops are smart. They got out their Geiger counters and checked out the area and found these American troops had been camped in an area that was massively contaminated for months. And they said, well, we're not going to camp here. We're going to go over there. And they went and found another spot. So the American troops came back, and they followed what is official policy. They requested a test for depleted uranium. And as the Army keeps saying, well, you know, we'll give them the test. We'll do everything we can to take care of our troops. And so when these guys went to their commanding officers and said, we want to get tested for this stuff, they were told, no, we're not going to test you. Don't worry, you didn't have any exposure. So finally they got some outside testing done with the help of the New York Daily News. And turns out of the 9 that were tested, 4 had depleted uranium in their urine. I haven't seen any numbers to see how high their exposure was. But according to the media reports, it was pretty high. In 91, we fired 320 tons of this stuff, mostly in southern Iraq and Kuwait. 320 tons that was left out there. These were in contaminated vehicles. These were in spent rounds that didn't hit. One thing to bear in mind about this is the amount that is oxidized or becomes aerosolized and can be breathed depends on whether or not it hits a hard target. We already heard a little bit about that. A lot of the rounds, particularly those that are fired by the A-10 aircraft, which fires a 30-millimeter DU billet, which is about this long. They showed a picture of it in the film. Something like 80% of those never actually hit the target because they'll come in and strafe. So those land essentially intact in the environment. And again, the Pentagon will say, well, you know, it's an intact round, and it's just giving off alpha particles. It can't hurt you. But the United Nations looked at this in the Balkans, where they did their the UN Environmental Program went and looked at some of these rounds. And what they found was that because of the weather and the oxidation, in some cases, 30% of the rounds had already corroded away and was making its way into the groundwater. And they're very alarmed about the situation in Iraq, particularly in this war, because unlike in 1991, most of the fighting has taken place in urban areas. It's taken place in the cities. And we don't know exactly how much was fired. And I'm going to pass out this fact sheet. Actually, could somebody grab these? We just put together a fact sheet that basically summarizes some of our some of the different studies and research we found. The Pentagon has given us a lowball figure of how much was used in this war. It was 128 tons from the Army and the Air Force. They don't give a figure for the Marine Corps. So that's like the low end of the range. I've seen reports, the Associated Press, for example, quoting unnamed military sources, says as high as 1,000 or maybe more, 1,000 tons. So we can safely assume that somewhere between 128 and 1,000 tons of depleted uranium was used in this war. Again, most of it in the cities. And who lives in the cities? Children. We go back to the study in Baltimore. And it's the only long-term health study that's been done on exposure to depleted uranium weapons. And what they keep saying over and over again is, well, we haven't seen much in the way of ill health effects. And we know that cancers may not start showing up for another few years. But we also know that children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radioactive exposure than adults are. They're also 10 to 20 times more sensitive to chemical toxicity than adults are. Okay? Because they're growing, their cells are dividing, there's a lot happening there that isn't happening in adults. And many of you may have seen the many photographs of kids climbing inside burned out tanks and playing in them for hours potentially. They're in these vehicles, they're getting an external radiation exposure, they're also resuspending the dust. They're breathing it in. They're getting it on their hands. They're eating and drinking with it on their hands. They're getting it, so they're getting an ingestion and into their GI tract. It doesn't surprise me at all that there are ill health effects being reported in Iraq, especially among children. You know, the Iraqi studies state themselves in their beginning that they didn't look deeply into causative factors. They didn't look at other potentially causative factors. And so the scientists, and if you listen to the National Academy of Sciences and the Presidential Advisory Committee on Gulf War Illnesses and all these folks, all their conclusions are basically, well, the jury's still out. We don't know. But, you know, the bottom line for me is that if you're using something that might be harmful to non-combatants, and especially children, you got to stop using it, period. It's not incumbent on children in this country that we have a responsibility for under international law. It's not incumbent on them to prove the ill health effects of a weapon we used. We have to prove that it's not harmful, not the other way around. So you, when you get into a lot of these scientific debates, and I've watched a lot of it going on in Washington, and there's a lot that goes on within the activist community. The bottom line for me is that there's more than enough evidence from the research the Pentagon itself has done to show that this stuff needs to be banned. I just want to go real quick over a couple of recommendations that we specifically made the Nuclear Policy Research Institute did a conference last summer on depleted uranium weapons. We brought together some, not by, by no means all, but some of the experts on the issue and talked about it. And then we tried to come to some conclusions based on what we learned out of that conference. One of them is that we absolutely have to study the civilian population in Iraq. We've got to provide them with medical care for these problems. We've got to do the utmost to protect civilians. I mean, when I was in basic training, they told us our responsibility is to protect civilians, is to preserve them, not to kill them, not to leave toxic junk in their environment. That's under international law and under just the laws of simple decency. You know, now that we've toppled the government of Iraq, we owe a responsibility to those people to do everything we can. So the areas we looked at was in particularly in areas where we know depleted uranium was used, we need to start medical monitoring, urine sampling of the population. We need to cordon off areas where it's known to be used, where there's contamination. We need to isolate tanks from the environment, armored vehicles, anything that's been hit by depleted uranium, so that kids won't get into them. Now, I read an article yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to follow up any details on this, but it indicated that a lot of the burned-out Iraqi tanks have been let go for salvage, and many of them have been transported to Jordan, where they're being disassembled and sold for scrap metal. And this, again, this stuff is contaminated. So, you know, we're spreading more of this stuff into yet another country. And Jordan, incidentally, already has very high levels of uranium in their groundwater. So it's not a good situation. So, you know, isolating the contaminated equipment, the rounds, the leaving the stuff that's lying around, picking it up, clean up. You know, it's what we would do if it was in the United States. Well, in theory, it's what we would do if it was in the United States. I shouldn't go too far out on a limb on that one. We also talked about independent epidemiological research. The Pentagon doesn't trust the Iraqi government and the Iraqi health ministry and the Iraqi hospitals to conduct studies of their own people. I don't trust the Pentagon to conduct studies of anybody because they're clearly politically motivated. So some third party needs to actually do this research. And not necessarily is a pretext to get it banned, because I think the information, enough information is there now to call for getting rid of this weapon. But the research needs to be done partly because the Iraqi people are going to be seeing these health effects literally through the rest of time, because it's there. And there's nothing we can do about it. You know, again, 4.5 billion years is the half-life. Then, our final recommendation is we need to get rid of the weapon. That's the bottom line, is that we're doing something here that, you know, regardless of whether you're for or against war, whether or not you're for or against, you know, this particular war or all that, the bottom line is that even, you know, if it was the most just war of any kind, you still don't use weapons that hurt non-combatants. You don't use things that hurt civilians. Now, I realize this whole war has been a disaster, and it should never have happened. But whatever the circumstances, this is the responsibility that the American people have. You know, I said one time years ago that I felt like when I pulled the trigger and killed those people, that in a way we all did, our whole country did. Regardless of how disenfranchised we feel right now by the media and by the major political parties and their parodying of each other, the fact is that because of the nature of our government as a republic, we all bear shared responsibility for the things our country does. And so the people here in this room and the people who are working on these things to try and prevent them from happening, we've got to keep doing it. We've got to get more people. We've got to work harder. We've got to really, really take this as far as possible. you know, going back to just strictly the anti-nuclear movement, when you think about millions of people marching in Central Park back in the height of the Cold War, that's the kind of thing that needs to be happening on these issues now. Thank you.